Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with alto, tenor, and baritone saxophonist, along with flutist Ian Hendrickson-Smith. These days, he is a part of the house band With Roots for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and remains quite busy from his base in New York City. Over the course of our interview, he talks about his actual roots that began in New Orleans and the dreams he had of a career in music, along with reflecting on many years playing out of a suitcase, along with what is possibly in store for the future, along with some surprises. So please dig it, my friends.
Thank you for taking a little time out for me tonight.
Yeah, of course. It was my pleasure.
Let me go ahead and get started real quick here. Let me just ask, what has been going on with you lately?
My primary job these days is on The Tonight Show. So that's like, takes up, you know, it's a full-time job. It takes up Monday through Friday during the day. And then 6 months a year, I play with Lachlan Harris at the Carlisle Hotel.
Yeah.
And that's a trio. Lachlan plays piano and bass. Piano and sings. And there's a bass player named Gianluca Renzi, Italian bass player. And we're playing like American songbook stuff. So that's kind of my primary jazz gig right now.
Right on.
I was working with Dr. Lonnie Smith a bunch with that octet we had about a year ago. That ran for about 2 years. We made a record called In the Beginning.
Yeah.
But that, he's not booking the octet anymore. It's just financially, it doesn't really make much sense.
Right.
And beyond that, I run, a record label named Rondette Jazz.
Okay.
And we just were brand new. So we started off with 9 releases and we have 3 new releases that are just kind of wrapping up their radio campaign. So they've been out for about 3 months. And
do you like running your own label?
I mean, this is my second crack at it. I had a label in the 90s called K-Pasta Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ran that one into the ground with my 2 partners. So I learned a lot from all the mistakes we made.
Yeah.
Running a label is very thankless and also really fun.
Right.
If you do it the right way, our business model is such that I get to make the majority of the artistic choices.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy that. You know, that I've been doing graphics and mixing and mastering and web design and all that stuff for years, working with this guy named Corey Weeds. He runs a jazz label called Cellar Live.
Yeah.
So I've been his designer for quite a while. I think I've done like probably 60 or 70 records for him. So, you know, it's a chance for me to get to do that, but without any, secondary opinions. It's just kind of, I just get to do my thing. So that end of it, I really enjoy, just the artistic freedom. But yeah, there's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of like tedious, you know, dealing with social media and dealing with shipping and answering crazy emails from customers and stuff, but
yeah.
You know, as we get bigger, hopefully we'll be able to farm some of that stuff out.
Right on. You know, the question I have about tonight's show is, you know, jazz musicians tend to kind of float. There's a lot of gigs they get involved with, and when you get kind of into a gig like that where it's a regular, almost a 9-to-5 kind of a thing, so to speak, do you like that regularity, that kind of thing that you can rely on?
Well, I mean, it's all about where you're at in your life. You know, I'm 41, I'm recently married, I'm at the point now where we're starting to think about, like, setting up a retirement and buying a house and all that kind of stuff, because stuff you don't think about in your 30s or your 20s when you're just touring and it's okay to be broke.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, this is a gig that came along at a perfect time in my life, where I need to make some money and be able to set some stuff aside and still have time at night to play other shows.
Sure.
So it's, you know, in a lot of ways it's a perfect job for me, man. It's, you know, it's tenuous because it's, you know, the show can end at any time. I mean, TV is very fickle.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it feels pretty solid right now. I mean, Jimmy's doing great and the ratings are good and we'll see how long it runs for.
Right.
But,
absolutely.
You know, musically, I love playing with the Roots and the guys are all great. And, you know, my horn section mate is Dave Guy, who I I spent 7 years on the road with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. So it's great to have him there. You know, we've been good friends since he was a kid.
Right.
And you know, it's cool. It's certainly not a jazz gig. It's, you know, it's R&B and rock and hip hop and everything else under the sky except for jazz. So it's,
yeah,
I have to kind of look elsewhere to keep myself satisfied on that end.
Well, yeah, it's a departure from the days of Doc, that's for sure. So let me go back to your lineage and your life, to your beginnings of growing up in the very jazz-rich New Orleans. What was that like for you? Did you dig growing up in New Orleans?
Well, I lived there as a child. I was exposed to some jazz when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, certainly like music festivals and Mardi Gras and the marching bands and all that stuff, but I didn't really get into jazz until I was in high school, and that was, we were living in Pennsylvania at that time.
Gotcha.
In the middle of nowhere in this town called State College, Pennsylvania, is where Penn State University is. So, they, you know, in a town pretty much devoid of any kind of culture.
Yeah.
So, any exposure I had to jazz was, you know, just going to a record store and buying records and reading books and trying to find videos and that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I moved to New York when I was 18 that I really got a full sense of what I was dealing with as far as, you know, the level of the guys that I'd be working with. And you know, it's pretty deep when you actually get to meet, you know, Junior Cook or Stanley Turrentine and
yeah.
George Coleman and those guys, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty heavy duty.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did the jazz light bulb go off for you? When was it like, this is what I want to do?
It's funny, I was a classical flutist first, so I had the great fortune, even in the middle of nowhere at State College, I had a great teacher named Diane Gold. And she had lived in New York for a bunch of years, and she was very open-minded. But she taught me, you know, work ethic, and something. By the time I was like 12, I was probably practicing 4 or 5 hours a day. You know, but just classical literature, like it wasn't any jazz at all. And then she was actually the one that first kind of pushed me towards jazz. And she was, you know, we were working on concertos and this is kind of a little known fact. But in the Baroque era, if, you know, at the end of a concerto, there's a cadenza. And the fact is written now, you know, these days, but apparently back then, the cadenza was a time to improvise. So, like, the class musicians would improvise their cadenza based on the chordal structure of what had happened before, which is very similar to what jazz musicians do, you know.
Yeah.
So she was kind of turning me on to that, and we were, you know, learning about what that meant, and I took to it. And she was, you know, she basically said, well, if you like that, you should probably start listening to some jazz. And she gave me a stack of, like, 10 records, and the very first one I put on is probably still my favorite record to date, and it's a Cannonball Adderley record, which is actually really kind of a Miles Davis record, but it's called Something Else.
Yeah.
It's Art Blakey, Sam Jones, Hank Jones, Miles, and Cannonball. And it was, you know, almost instantaneous. It was, you know, it's like you said, it's like a light bulb thing. I heard that, and I heard Cannonball, and I was like, I got to do that. You know, so I think within a couple of months, I had an alto, and I found a teacher in town, and, you know, sort of just kind of made my way through it as best I could with what I had access to.
Yeah.
I would go to Harrisburg sometimes to see, they would have a jazz festival occasionally, and the first real show I saw was a double bill. It was Stanley Turrentine Quartet and then the George Coleman Quartet.
Yeah,
I think Stanley T had Billy Hart and a couple guys from D.C. with him. I can't remember their names. And George had Harold Mayburn and Billy Higgins. It might have been Ron Carter. I can't exactly remember. It was a long time ago. But you know that was certainly the convincing thing. I was like, I really want to do that. So at that point, I kind of started practicing saxophone more than flute, and by the time it was time to apply to colleges, I ended up just only applying to jazz programs.
Right on. So when you did get to the Manhattan School of Music, what do you remember about those years? What do you remember, what really sunk in from their teachings for your career in jazz?
Well, I mean, the school itself was cool. I mean, if I had to do over again, I probably would have done like a year or two and then dropped out. You know,
yeah.
Honestly, the degree itself has never, ever meant anything to my career. There's never been one instance where someone's been like, are you available for this job? Let me see your degree, you know.
Right.
That's never come into play. But the networking factor, I mean, I still work with a lot of the guys that I went to school with, like namely Ryan Kaiser, Jeremy Manassia, Al Street, Charles Ruggiero. These are guys, you know, guys that I'm still playing with, you know, 23 years later. But the school was like kind of like an entrance, like a way to move here and have a 4-year leeway to not worry about paying bills. I mean, you're just in school, living off of student loans, you know. So it was a way to get here.
Yeah.
But the real education was just being in the city and going to the clubs and hanging out with the cats. I mean, I had the amazing fortune of becoming Ryan Kaiser's roommate. You know who Ryan Kaiser is?
Yes, absolutely.
He's still probably one of my favorite trumpet players. You know, I mean, obviously I'm biased, but we ended up being roommates for 9 years. And when I moved in with him, like, I could barely play a bird solo, you know.
Yeah.
And he was so far advanced, especially at that young age. And he's 1 year older than me, so, you know, I was 19, he was 20.
Yeah.
And just, you know, his record collection was huge, and the way he would practice was very enlightening, and you know, guys, Clark Terry would stop by the crib, and
wow.
Charlie Hayden was, you know, he was on such a high level that it just kind of, like, injected me into this next level of, like, of just how to hang and listen to jazz and what it, you know, it just kind of shows you how to act, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, those were kind of the more formative elements of that time. Like, when I first got here, it was just being around the cats. Philip Harper from, you know, the Harper Brothers and Art Blakey was definitely a prominent cat on our scene back then. And he was substantially older than us, so he had a lot of stories to tell and would kind of, you know, pull our coattails if we were doing something wrong. And, you know, it's part of the way jazz is handed down is the older guys, you know, the really cool ones, the older guys will take the time and take you aside and tell you what's what, you know.
You know, I always like to call those older cats the Jazz Jedi Council, because you probably can't help but when you're around them by osmosis pick up not only their cool, but that wisdom they just ooze with.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
At this point right now, it's probably safe to say that you're one of the more sought-after musicians in New York City. How did you get to that point?
Well, I don't know how true it is, honestly. I mean, it's funny, the jazz thing in New York is very clicky.
Yeah.
So, like, you get into your various cliques that you run with. Based primarily on, like, the style of jazz that you're into. If it's, like, you know, straight ahead or kind of more pushy, modern, straight ahead, or if you're really old school bebop, or if you're avant-garde, or, you know, whatever label you want to put on it.
Yeah.
Those are the guys you tend to run with, and those are the calls you tend to get, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess I've always steered towards, like, the more soulful, you know, blues-based side of jazz music, and so those are the kind of calls that I tend to get, you know, like the Dr. Lonnie Smith gig, but also guys around town kind of know me as a bit of a hustler, and like I'm a guy that can kind of get things done. Like, if you need someone to do arrangements or organize something, or, you know, get a record mixed and get it looking right, and, you know, I know the right photographers to call, just because I'm kind of been in the production side of, you know, making jazz records for a long time now.
Sure.
So those are the skills you kind of develop along the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now my primary gig is really The Tonight Show and then Lawson Harris.
Yeah.
I think people kind of assume that I'm unavailable right now. So the phone doesn't ring quite as much as it was before I got the Tonight Show gig.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy with what I have right now. I mean, it's almost too much as it is.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I'd say like 98% of the year, I get to stay home, which is pretty unbelievable, man. Because basically, if you sign up to be a professional musician, like, you're signing up to live out of a suitcase for a good chunk of the year.
Yeah.
Just being on the road is part of it. And I did that for a solid 10 years, like 9-10 months a year. So now I'm ready to sleep in my own bed. You know?
Yeah. Well, so when you look back on your life, you look back on all those years when you were touring and you were constantly busy, is there a period in your life where you think, God, there was so much creativity, so much output, so much going on? Is there a period that really sticks out in your head?
That's a good question. It's all a bit of a blur. I mean, I was forced to look back. I'm just switching over to a new publishing administrator. So we're going through every record that I played on and trying to re-register everything with this new company. And I was like, damn, look at, it's probably over 100 records that I played on, something like that. 10 as a leader and then 90 as a sideman or something like that.
Yeah.
All that time in the studio and all that time in airplanes and playing gigs, there's not really any one period that sticks out. Certainly there's bright spots, like the Al Green record I got to play on was a huge, meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
The first couple tours I did with Amy Winehouse were really different. That was the first really high level gig I had ever done.
Yeah.
That was, every show was really, really packed and we're playing at the Grammys and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, a lot of my favorite gigs have just been my gigs as a leader in some crappy jazz club,
Yeah.
Those are some of my fondest memories are playing my own music. And sadly, I don't get to do that enough these days just because I told you earlier, I'm kind of in a zone where I'm in a different period in my life where I'm thinking about the future, not just what's right in front of my face. So I'm more kind of focused on what pays the bills right now.
Yeah.
So I'm not booking as many gigs as a leader as I would like, but just artistically speaking. But, basically, if I'm going to do that, I'm basically paying to play, and it's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
So, doesn't make any sense right now.
But, yeah,
I still try to do it when I can. I have a gig in 2 weeks, but it's not going to be a jazz gig. It's going to be, kind of a party band. No matter what, I'm having fun, man. I have equal love for R&B as I do for jazz, but jazz, if you don't play it, it goes away. It's not like riding a bike. It's something you have to keep working at.
Right on. So you played with a lot of people throughout your career. I mean, your bio list, Rufus Wainwright, of course, you're playing with the Roots every day, Dr. Lonnie Smith. You're going all over the place. Mark Ronson. Is there anybody out there that you would really like to play with, whether it's in the jazz world or other genres? Is there someone you're like, man, I'd love to get on stage with that person?
That's another good question. My number one jazz artist that I've always wanted to play with is, almost since day one, was Dr. Lonnie Smith.
Yeah.
I've always been the hugest fan of his. So bucket list wise, he was number one for sure.
Right on.
Etta Jones was always one of my favorites. I only got to play with her twice, but that was huge. Of anyone left alive, it's tough because most of them are saxophone players.
Yeah.
I love Lou Donaldson to death, and I love George Coleman to death.
Yeah.
I would love to play with Harold Mayburn some more. I mean, we've done a few gigs where we were both sidemen.
Yeah.
The guys that I would really like Yeah, I would love to have played with Art Blakey or like Elvin Jones, but those guys are gone, sadly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who's left. It's like it's not even like on my radar right now. I mean, who is there that's working that I would even have the option to play with?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's really gotten slim just because of the reality of Cassie getting old.
Yeah, mortality, totally.
Yeah,
What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Folgers in your cup. I love to work, so. For me, every day is like the greatest day because I love playing saxophone and I love having steady work and steady income. I have a great wife, I have a great dog, I have a great apartment. Right now things are really well and great. So, I mean, I don't know. It's every day is kind of like, even if it's routine, it's never really routine. I mean, I'm going into 30 Rock every day and taping the Tonight Show and always different, it's always fun, exciting, and there's always a lot of pressure, so you can never really get lazy on that job.
Yeah.
And then every time I go to play jazz, I'm terrified every time.
Yeah.
You know, I take it very seriously, the lineage and the history and trying to stay aware of my contribution to that, you know, hopefully to the art form and trying to take that responsibility very seriously. So, I mean, I'm not kidding. Like, when I go to play jazz, I'm terrified on the way to the gig.
Wow.
I consider it a pretty serious responsibility. So, I try to practice and I try to stay humble and just treat each gig like it could be the last one and try to have fun and entertain people. I mean, that's always been one of my biggest goals in life, was just to entertain people. And not be one of those artists that, you know, I know a lot, this is another conversation, but you know, a lot of people are into the whole turning your back to the audience and that Miles earned the right to do that. And that's great. And I applaud all those people, but like, that's not where I'm coming from. I want people to like, tap their toes and smile and dance and have fun. You know, that's the kind of music that I want to be involved with.
Sure. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A musician.
Right on.
I didn't know what. You know, like I told you, I was a classical flutist. For me, it was, you know, it's really funny. I was really into the Jim Henson movies. I'm a huge Jim Henson fan, like Muppets and otherwise.
Yeah.
And it was that movie, The Dark Crystal. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh yeah.
Actually, it's a kind of a dark movie, man. But
yeah.
One of the characters, one of the good, you know, the good versus evil, one of the good characters, played this weird kind of like two-layered flute thing.
Yeah.
And I was real little when that movie came out, but I remember being just incredibly fascinated with that. And I think it was that moment I was like, man, I want to do something that jams, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. I certainly knew very young that's something that I wanted to do forever.
Yeah. That was up your alley. You know, the one thing I always like to ask musicians is, if you think back throughout your life, do you have a good story that comes to mind? Just a really good, whether it's jazz or music story that's just like, man, this is a good one.
I probably have 100 of them, but probably most of them are rated R or worse.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's jazz musicians I love jazz musicians more than most other types of musicians for a bunch of reasons. I mean, A, you have to be a smart person to play that music.
Yeah,
because it goes by so quickly and it takes so much work to get to the point where you can even, you know, swing your way out of a tree. It's like, you know, so I love being around jazz musicians and most of them have struggled and have been, you know, pissed on and been homeless. So a lot of them are dark, you know, so there's like a dark, like incredibly smart you know, trod upon type of humor that goes with that music.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a black music, so it's like the black, you have to appreciate black culture if you're into jazz music or R&B. It's like, there's so many stories. I'm just not sure which ones I could tell without getting myself in trouble.
Yeah. No, that's good. What you ended up doing with that is you ended up doing something I didn't think you were going to do, but you really gave a good synopsis of jazz musicians, and that's awesome. What I want to ask you next is, if we get together in 10 years from now, we get on the phone, I'm like, Ian, what's up? What's been going on? What do you think you're going to be happiest to tell me about?
Oh, well, probably my blossoming garden and, you know, the three dogs and two goats we have. I mean, that's, you know, because my wife and I, ultimately, that's our goal, is to be able to have, we want to have a crash pad in the city so I can continue to play jobs at night here. And obviously we're hoping that the Tonight Show job goes for a long time.
Yeah.
But we want to have a country house upstate somewhere with like a small farm and like a barn and that whole business. And you know, I'm hoping that my record label will be, much more substantial at that point. About 5 years ago, I started plans to open a jazz club in the city.
Yeah.
And through various, you know, various reasons, obviously it's a very difficult thing to do in New York or anywhere, but it didn't pan out in the timing that I'd hoped, but that's something I still really want to do.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm not sure if I want to open it in the city or if it will be a 7-day-a-week thing. But I do want to have some sort of situation where I'm booking music on a regular basis in some sort of venue, whatever that ends up being.
Yeah,
yeah, those are my three main things. I mean, you know, be alive and happy, have a house, still be playing, and have the label going, and have some sort of club.
Yeah, you got a dream, man. That's for sure.
Man, you gotta set yourself high and not be dark when you get knocked back. You know,
that's right.
I look at it.
That's right, exactly. Ian, man, stay cool, man. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great, man. I appreciate you too, man. Thanks for getting in touch, man. Stay in touch.
Right on.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Ian for his time and quality music in both jazz and well beyond. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.